Hey everybody, KMO here. This is not exactly a regular episode of the KMO show, so I'm not going to put a number on it. But the day before yesterday, Doug Lane did a 15-hour live stream to commemorate his first 15 years in podcasting. And he invited me to be the first guest on the stream, which means I had to get up earlier than anybody else, but no earlier than I normally would have. And we talked for about 90 minutes, so I'm going to share that with you. On Tuesdays and Thursdays, I write a Substack post, and I also record an audio version of it, so I will also include the post that I recorded, well, that I wrote and recorded immediately after getting off the live stream with Doug. And it was kind of funny, because I spent a good long time writing it, then I recorded it, then I uploaded it, then I went and did some other stuff, and then I tuned back into the live stream and Doug was still at it. In fact, I tuned in time to hear him have kind of a shouting match with Ben Burgess. They talked over each other quite a bit and Ben threatened to walk. But then they made up and it ended on a more congenial note. Anyway, Doug was fresh as a daisy because it was early in the morning when he and I talked for his 15-hour live stream. So here is that conversation.
Okay, so KMO is here. It's 8:01. Hi, KMO.
Hey, Doug. 7:01 here.
Oh yeah.
So that was a best of or something you were playing just now.
Yeah, right? It was just a clip from an interview I did with Margaret Kimberly. It was actually a pretty recent interview. Margaret Kimberly was one of the first people to come on the podcast, you know, but I think in my memory, you are amongst the very first people to come onto the podcast and one of the first people who had me on their podcast. So without you, KMO, there would be no Diet Soap. You introduced my podcast to your audience. I felt like I started to get listeners because of our collaboration. And so I had to have you on the 15-year anniversary.
Do you remember what year we met up in New York at the Left Forum?
Oh boy. Yeah, I think it was it 2015?
That sounds right. Yeah. I moved out of New York at the beginning of 2016, so it couldn't have been later than that. So I was not in New York for the 2016 Left Forum, but I remember you and I were recording a conversation at the Zero Books booth. Mm-hmm. And somebody walked by and recognized us and said, "Oh, it's my two favorite podcasters." And nice. Yeah, I wonder if there's much overlap between our audiences. I mean, I'm not podcasting much these days. I'm more writing, but I suspect that our audiences have diverged since the early days.
Yeah, I think they'd already diverged a bit by then, but we haven't apparently. Leroy Jenkins says, "Y'all twins?"
I'll take that as a compliment because I'm the older of the two of us.
Yeah, there you go. Exactly. I'll take it as a compliment because you're considerably thinner than I am. So, I still have people who contact me from time to time, listeners to the podcast, people who watch the channel, who have been watching and following Diet Soap since before Zero Books, and I think of those people as the KMO people.
The KMO people are largely a mixture of the Psychedelic Salon people and honestly the Dmitry Orlov people, because he had a prominent link to my podcast on his blog for many years.
Oh yeah. Yeah. How is Dmitry Orlov doing? Is he still around?
You know, he's somebody that I know in person and don't intend to speak ill of him, but his content these days is not anything that I'm particularly interested in, and certainly not interested in boosting. He's moved to Russia and he's stridently pro-Putin, pro-Russia in the Ukraine war, and says some very ugly things about Ukrainians to justify the war. So I'm not interested.
Right now on the left, there's a certain contingent which is all aligned with Dmitry Orlov.
I kind of doubt they're aligned with the particulars. Like his position is that Ukrainian soils are iodine deficient, which makes all Ukrainians basically
you know, morons, that Ukrainian is only a separate language because it's a pidgin Russian that, you know, the retarded Ukrainians can't speak Russian correctly. So somebody formalized, you know, their butchery of the language and called it another language. Yeah, I'd be surprised if the lefties were going that far.
Don't underestimate the degree to which the left will stoop. I'm sure they might do that. Someone says in the chat, is either Doug, I guess now you are, this is a KMO. His name is not Doug. No. Forgetting or being awkward about the answer, but I don't know what the question was. I missed the question. So Spencer, if you could type in the question that you want me to answer, because he says, I think he'd address that better now. So I'd like to know what the question was. Yeah, so KMO, what you just said that you are not podcasting as much.
Right.
Are you still, but you are still putting out the CROM?
Well, not the CROM podcast. I have lost access to the CROM RSS feed. A while ago, I was being paid to podcast for a show called the Padverb Podcast. Mm-hmm. And when that had run its course, I started a new one called the KMO Show, which can be found at kmo.show, to keep it simple. Mm-hmm. And I just put out an episode recently, but it was mostly to say, hey, I've written a science fiction novel. Here's a sample. Actually, the sample that I put out was not the science fiction novel, but it was a prequel novella that I'm serializing or have serialized on Substack.
I want you to know that I have matured over mm-hmm. the years, because when we started out, if I heard that you were writing a science fiction novel, I would have been filled with envy and rage and thought you'd get, you know, stay in your lane, KMO. This is my dream.
Well, I'm glad you're past that.
But I'm so past it now.
So have you read any of it?
I read a bit of it. I started it. But you know, it seems to me it's more tongue in cheek than what maybe I might write.
So this is it, by the way. Let's see. I need to turn off this screen blur or not. I'll just tell you the title. You know the title. I'll tell the
Yeah, right here. It's Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt. Kuiper Belt.
Yeah. Something I've noticed recently is that a lot of people on the left who say that they trust the science are not familiar with the Kuiper Belt, which they think it's an element of my science fiction world building, when in fact it is an actual feature of our solar system.
If you assume that the Earth isn't flat, what is the Kuiper Belt again? Is it all these meteors that divide part of the solar system, something like that? Am I getting it close?
Well, it's kind of a big brother to the asteroid belt, but mm-hmm. the asteroid belt is in close, so that solar radiation blows off all of the all of the ice. And out in the Kuiper Belt, it's so far from the sun that most of those objects, you know, many of them are rocky or have rocky components, but they're also largely made of frozen methane and ammonia and water ice. So it's a very icy place out there in the Kuiper Belt. And the Kuiper Belt is beyond the orbit of Neptune.
Okay. All right. And so that's where all of this takes place, your novel.
That's where the human civilization that the reader has access to is located. There's a Dyson sphere around the sun, between where the asteroid belt used to be, between the orbits of Mars and Jupiter. And what goes on inside the Dyson sphere, or the curtain, as the people out in the Kuiper Belt call it, is unknown to the reader. But there is a character who comes from there, but everybody who comes out from that inner system has a different story to tell. You know, there's a standard list of questions that anybody coming from the inner system has to answer, and their answers are not consistent.
You know, I've often said, I want to point this out, like you, like the Kuiper Belt, what's that? And I'm a science fiction writer. It's sad, right? But I'm not actually. I'm a slipstream writer. I'm a magical realist. Basically, my version of science was critical theory. Mm-hmm. I'm absolutely the worst. Like, I should be, you know, barred from teaching ever. If I ever got a chance to teach in Florida, DeSantis should keep me away from the students, like with my critical theories instead of science and objectivity. So I'm the worst. So
I don't see you moving to Florida, by the way.
No, well, it's lovely there though. But I'm just going to read a paragraph because I want to, from your novel, because I want to ask you about a couple of things, a couple of sure. names here. Captain Trix, acting captain, Cook reminded himself, knew the ship better than anyone. She'd been doing the previous captain's job for the last five outings, at least. The actual captain disappeared into his quarters for longer and longer, delegating more and more responsibility to Trix, spelled like the cereal, until he finally emerged feet first. Now they had no official captain, but everyone still looked to Trish Nixon to do whatever it is the captains do. She should get a captain's share. It's not like money was tight, not anymore. In all the years that Cook had lived and worked on the nipple, they'd lived hand to mouth, always scrounging or taking sketchy jobs that put them on the wrong side of the law. No longer. For the first time in forever, Persephone's lost nipple ring was fully stocked with food, water, fuel, ammunition, drones, mining pods, and duplicates for all critical components. Thanks to the DAO, everything was topped off, overhauled, and updated. Persephone's lost nipple ring is the name
of the ship.
Yeah. Of the ship.
And in their old sort of hand-to-mouth days, it was called the nipple, and now that they're upscaling their image, it's the Persephone.
Yeah, okay. So so how did you come to write this novel, and where can people get it?
Well, I'll answer the second question first, because it's simpler. Amazon. Mm-hmm. Okay. And only Amazon. I'm exclusive with them. Mm-hmm. Last summer, I learned of the existence of programs, AI programs that would write for you. You know, you would give them a list of characters and some plot points and things like that. You know, however much you wanted to contribute, you could contribute, hand it over to the AI, and it would fill in the blanks. And I wanted to give it a try.
Oh, no, really?
Yeah.
This is the story of the origin of the novel. Okay.
I started with a program called PseudoWrite, which is S-U-D-O, but it sounds like pseudo P-S-E or P-S-E-U-D-O. Anyway, I had a couple characters in mind, and I told the AI what it was that I wanted, and I gave it, you know, I gave it the characters, I gave it the setting, I gave it a few plot elements, and said, okay, go. And what it turned out was just terrible. Oh. And so I gave it more. I said, okay, not like that, like this. And what it kept churning out was just like fanfic, you know, it was not anything I would read. Mm-hmm. And there was a portion of the platform that allowed you to put in your own text, and it would supposedly copy your writing style. So just to give it an idea of the style that I wanted, I wrote the first scene of the novel and I pasted it in, and it didn't work. Like, I just got an error message. But then I thought, well, I'll try again with a different platform. And I wrote the second scene of the novel, just, you know, to have a longer block of you know, stylized text that the AI can model. And that other program didn't produce any better results. But by then I'd written two scenes. So I just kept writing. I tried to outline, I'm sure you're familiar with the pantser plotter distinction, or as George R.R. Martin says, the architects versus the gardeners. Mm-hmm. I'm very much a gardener. I tried to be an architect. I would write an outline, and then when I would go to write the actual text, the characters didn't follow the outline. So I would have to scrap the outline and write it again, you know, to be consistent with what the characters had done, and again deviate. You know, when I go to actually write the dialogue and such, it just didn't come out the way I had planned it to. And so eventually I just had a few plot points in mind, and this was the best part of writing the whole thing. I would get up before sunrise every day, put the coffee on, take the dog out for a walk, come back in, and it's still dark. I mean, today it's cloudy. It would normally be light around here. Mm-hmm. But in the dark, I'd sit there and start writing, and I wouldn't know, you know, what was going to happen mm-hmm. in that writing session. And that was a lot of fun. That was really exciting. Now I'm trying to plot the sequel, and I'm trying to do research, and I'm trying to structure it before I start writing, because doing it the way I did, you end up writing a lot of stuff that you don't use.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm trying to be an architect now, but I'm really just a gardener.
Well, earlier on in this, what will be a 15-hour stream, can you believe I'm doing this?
Madness. I'm glad I'm at the front and not at the back.
Yeah. I mentioned that a lot of people who are on the left, particularly, but I think it's just true of overall, but who go into political podcasting, let's say, are actually usually artists of some kind trying to build careers somewhere else. And then this is like what they fall into. For you, you were a comic strip artist. You were an artist, visual artist, and you became a podcaster to promote that or just in addition to that. But how did you, I mean, right now you've got this novel you've written and you're going to try to promote your novel to your podcaster listeners, right? Or you are doing that. So how did you come to podcasting and how did that fit into your creative life when you did that?
How long of an answer do you want?
Let's see, I got 15 hours came out. Okay. So as long as you want to give.
So yeah, in college, I majored mostly in philosophy. Mm-hmm. So I had that stuff going on up in my head, but I was also a cartoonist. I wanted to do comic books, superhero type stuff. But by then I was past the superhero stuff, but this is when, Alan Moore was making a name for himself, getting to be a big deal. So I wanted to write comics as well, but I was still, mostly focused on the illustration. But I did a comic strip for the university newspaper. It was called C, just the letter C. And I was also participating in online discussions. This is very early on. This is like really before the web. And it was Usenet and what is the other one? The email one, listserv discussion groups. And I often made reference to a thing called the C realm, which was like the realm of consciousness, sort of a new sphere sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And a friend of mine, just without me asking him to, registered the domain name crealm.com and handed the keys to me. So this is like in 94, 95. I mean,
wow.
Yeah, really early. Like the discussions were happening before I'd ever seen the first Mosaic web browser. But then as soon as the web came along, I had a website that somebody else secured for me and they chose the name and it was crealm. But, it was I had coined the phrase. And then, I moved to Seattle. I worked for Amazon. I was very busy doing that stuff. But when I left Amazon, I wanted to be a cartoonist. I spent all day, writing and drawing comics that were based on the comic strip from the newspaper, which was never going to go anywhere. I look at it now. I'm like, that stuff was way too esoteric. The art style was not polished enough to, just ride on the art by itself. Mm-hmm. It was just never going to happen. But, at the time I'm in my early 30s and very, very ambitious and, hobbled by Dunning-Kruger syndrome, thinking that my stuff was better than it was. Mm. But I had money and I was very interested, and this is before podcasting, but I had the Terrence McKenna Alien Dreamtime CD and I sought out any Terrence McKenna, recordings that I could. Mm-hmm. And I was fascinated by not only, the topics he was talking about, but also just what he did, with his weird nasally voice and all his cool references just to stand up in front of audiences and rant. And I wanted to do that. I didn't know exactly how to do that, but I wanted to do that.
What year was this again?
This is like 96. This is the latter half of the 90s.
Mm-hmm. And you were in your early 30s already then?
I was born in 68, so I turned 30 in 98.
Yeah.
And then when I left Amazon and I had some money, I wanted to go to the Amazon and drink ayahuasca. And I did. And mm-hmm. then the next year I wanted to go back and I bought a video camera just to, shoot images of ceremonies in the jungle and whatnot. But I discovered that when I got there, and I hadn't planned to do this, I just started sitting people down who lived there, gringos mostly, who had moved there, and interviewing them. And I had no intention of broadcasting. I didn't know how I would broadcast the interviews. I didn't know how I would share a full motion video with anybody, or even audio, but I just started interviewing people. And then a few years later, podcasting comes along. Oh, I should also mention that in college, I took, even before college, when I was in high school, I joined a book club. One of those things where, you would tear stamps off a big page and lick them and stick them down to your mm-hmm. return form and get mm-hmm. a bunch of books for a penny each. I bought one on voice and articulation. And I did the exercises. Like when I was just a slacker in high school, for some reason, I was doing voice and articulation exercises. And I took some acting courses in a community college. And then in university, I took another voice and articulation class. Mm-hmm. So, you know, without knowing of the existence of podcasts, I had been preparing to do podcasts for like a decade. And then 2006 rolls around and I discovered the Psychedelic Salon podcast and the Dope Fiend podcast and the Viking Youth Power Hour. And within a couple months of knowing that podcasts exist, I was doing them.
Wow.
Yeah. So I had been preparing to do podcasts without knowing it for over a decade.
Right. Did you ever use the footage that you got?
Don't even know where it is.
Yeah.
It's on mini DV video cassette tapes. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't know how to, I'd have to find the camera. I'd have to find a way to transfer them. It's not on the agenda.
Well, just to tell the parallel story, I was working, I think at the time you were podcasting that when I discovered your podcast, you were working at Comcast.
No, worked for Comcast for quite a while after.
No,
that.
I said when I discovered.
Oh, yes. Yeah. I was thinking about my start, which was a couple of years earlier.
Right. No, I was, when I discovered your podcast, you were working for Comcast as was I. I was commuting to the Comcast call center and taking calls for, I was part of the sales team there. I lasted about 2 years. Yeah. In Portland, in Beaverton, outside of Portland. And, so I commute from Portland to Beaverton, which is just a suburb. And
I've been to Beaverton. I know Beaverton.
Yeah. And the Beaverton call center. And so and the way I discovered podcasts was I won a contest, a sales contest at Comcast, and got a little iPod, like an iPod mini as my prize. So, I would never have listened to podcasts except I got this prize. And so I started using it to kill time when I was commuting, and I'd listened to your podcast and the Alex Jones podcast and not the Dope Fiend, the Psychedelic Salon you mentioned, and a bunch of NPR stuff and what have you, but I've told this story lots of times, but I'll tell it, it's appropriate to tell on this stream, but what I was really struck by was that It over the course of listening to several episodes of your podcast, it dawned on me that you were not working for a radio station. You were not associated with any nonprofit, that you didn't have an institution backing you of any kind, but you
just some dude
who would record podcasts in your pickup truck using an old laptop, and that you sounded very polished and professional. You were very good at it. And I thought, well, hell, if he can do this, maybe I can. So I started talking to my laptop originally without a microphone or anything. And then, and this is the kind of guy I am. I was like, I remember for the first like 10 to 20 episodes, part of my pitch would be, if you donate to the podcast, I'll buy a microphone.
But you had made like artistic mixtapes back in the day, right? So you had been preparing, because the early Diet Soap episodes were very consciously edited, expressively edited, I would say. And so you too had been preparing to do podcasts without knowing that that's what you were preparing to do.
That's true. And then what happened to the podcast is over time, because I started doing YouTube, really, I stopped editing the podcast like I used to. They became unedited kind of live streams. And the editing went into making these video montages where I tried to be Adam Curtis.
Yeah.
But
I think Adam Curtis is more popular now, but I suspected that when you first started doing that, I was one of the few people who recognized, who you were paying homage to with those efforts.
Right, yeah. No, he's pretty popular now. I think he comes and goes. Whenever he has something come out, he percolates up in the consciousness.
Well, nothing that he's done, I think, has really had the impact of The Century of the Self, which was one of his earlier documentary series. I mean, that one was so applicable to everybody's life, and it just didn't seem to have an axe to grind, really, a political axe to grind, at least not a partisan one. Whereas, you know, his newer stuff, I enjoy it, but it seems like less focused and less less on point, less on target. It seems so. His newer stuff seems more meandering, or you have to invest more to find the through line.
So back to the beginning of the podcast for you, you started podcasting. How long did it take you to realize that there's a potential for this to actually be, to make your living?
This is horrible. You're still with Podomatic. I've long since moved on. But when I first started with Podomatic, they were vastly overinflating stats. Like anytime a search spider, accessed the site, they counted that as a listen. Mm-hmm. So early on, I thought my audience was much larger than it really was.
Mm-hmm.
And there was much gnashing of teeth when the stats were corrected, and everybody, like, I hadn't done this, but other people who were podcasting at the same time and also thought they had a much larger audience than they did had gone out and found sponsors and advertisers and whatnot, you know, based on these stats. And, mm-hmm. you know, all that was kicked out from under them. With me, it was all just psychological.
Mm-hmm.
But, it's never really provided a great living. I would certainly have been better off just getting a job and, you know, working a job. What was the, you were shushing somebody else, not me.
I was shushing you.
Oh,
don't
really?
Say that. Don't say get a job. No.
I'm not telling you to get a job.
No. Actually, I'm kidding. You know, I didn't start doing it professionally until I started working for Zero Books. It was only something I did on the side up until that point. And then it landed me the job in Zero Books. So then I did that, you know, but I got a salary from them. And you've done it professionally too for a company when you were doing Padver.
Yes. And also I got the cartooning job that I was doing for a few years because of the podcast. The person who ran the political advocacy organization that I was doing it for, he knew of me because of the C-Rome podcast.
Right. But so as far as like the stats on Podomatic, I'm still on Podomatic. And the story there is I tried to leave and the listenership dropped off. So I came back and I just can't leave. And I signed up on Podomatic because it was free at first.
Yeah.
Right. So first one's free. Now you're locked in. Number one philosophy podcast on Podomatic.
Right? Sweet.
So, yep. Has been that way for years. But about a year ago, actually, I saw a big drop in the listenership for Diet Soap. And I was panicking. And then I contacted them and they're like, oh yeah, sorry, but we were counting robots and things that we shouldn't.
Again.
Yeah.
Like a decade and a half later, they did the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But you did, despite the fact that you had an inflated notion of your listenership, you did have a pretty substantial listenership and a membership site. And you did, I remember you went on a big tour across the United States with Neil Kramer.
Yeah. And then another one later.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And now, I mean,
When you say big tour, it was a couch surfing tour. It was.
But you would.
I couldn't have funded it.
Yeah, right. But you showed up in these towns, and people, like hundreds of 100 or so people, would show up in each location that you appeared at.
That would be a big crowd for me. 100.
I remember it was about 100. Don't correct me on this one.
About
100 people showed
Inflate
up.
Inflate me. Go for it.
Yeah. at the pub in Portland when you came through.
That was one of the bigger crowds in that tour.
Right. And some of the people there were members of Sweta, which I had mentioned earlier in the stream, Jason Horsley's people.
Oh.
I met some of his cult members there. And they.
Did you go to the party afterwards?
No, I don't think I did, but I hung around the pub. I mean, it was in a pub, so I got it.
Oh, I'm there was a Portland stop. The next tour, remember it was at a record store / laundromat.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And there was a party after that one where the party was much more like it seemed like there were more people at the party than there was at the actual event. But one of my listeners that I had, some correspondence with prior he was a kind of survivalist guy, and he brought a very, very large rifle. It was like on a bipod, and he had it set up in the kitchen, which was traumatizing to some of the Portlandians in attendance.
I bet. Yeah, I wouldn't want to be at a party with a giant, or if someone brings in a rifle on a tripod and sets it up.
You would have wanted to be at this party. I'm surprised.
I'm sure I would have. Well, but anyway, I remember the first one, and Jason Horsley's people showed up, like about four or five of them, and they wanted to talk to me because I would interview Jason, and I was the only one who ever talked to Jason that they heard who was skeptical with him and treated him like just a guy rather right. than sort of God, which is what he was, of course. But yeah, that was an interesting time. And it was, I mean, I was a Marxist even then, or trying to be a Marxist, but it was definitely not our crossover audience was not like filled with leftists or committed Verso reading, you know, people. It was like a mix of people who are just kind of dissatisfied. And so you might get a survivalist showing up.
Yeah.
Even to a Diet Coke event, maybe.
Well, my audience, you know, what remains of it is still, I mean, some of them are politically left, but they're not young people, I should say. Mm-hmm. You know, my audience tends to be older, and they don't have the fanaticism of youth. They might have, you know, the echo of the fanaticism of their own youth, mm-hmm. but, you know, kids or people who were young in the 60s, 70s, and 80s are not nearly as fervent as young people today. You know, even if they have roughly the same politics, mm-hmm. We are in a strangely, you know, rabid period. Like, you're old enough to remember saner times. Mm-hmm. And now is a weird, weird time. And, you know, young people, particularly ones who came up after the iPhone, I do not envy them trying to make sense of the world. Because it's just going to get worse. It's going to get so much worse as AI penetrates deeper into everybody's daily experience. You know, the AIs are all very, you know, speech policey. If you try to talk to ChatGPT or Claude or Pi or something like that about anything political, you know, they definitely carry the banner for the Silicon Valley, you know, the mindset, the political allegiance of the tech elite. And you can talk them out of it, but since they don't remember, they don't make any long-term changes to their personality or their worldview based on conversations with users, you know, the next time you talk with them about it, they're right back to the baseline of, you know, basically their political ideology is that of the HR department at Google.
Sounds like everybody else on Twitter.
Yeah. But you can, you know, Twitter is a million voices. It's way more than a million, but, you know, from your perspective, it's the Chinese equivalent of 10,000, you know, the ancient Chinese used to say the 10,000 things when they meant, you know, uncountably large, where now 10,000 is nothing. Mm-hmm. It's trivial. But you know, there's a million voices on Twitter, and you can tune in to the ones that are copacetic to your, you know, your point of view, and either tune out or discount the rest. You can't really do that with the AI. I mean, it is just, it knows so much, and it is so useful that you can't really set its worldview to the side. You have to constantly contend with it, or, you know, do like professional broadcasters do and just adopt its worldview and internalize the values, as Noam Chomsky would say, and just, you know, sell out and ideologically speaking, not necessarily, you know, politically or professionally, but we're still in the very, very early days. I mean, most people don't have much interaction with AI that they know about, and that will just not remain the case. Even the people, and there's a lot of like anti-tech curmudgeons in my audience, which is weird because I've always been, you know, pretty technophilic. Mm-hmm. Even the people who, you know, who say absolutely I will have no interaction whatsoever with AI, it's like, yeah, good luck with that. Those are the people who said, you know, in 2010 that they'd never carry a smartphone. It's like, yeah, there's a few still holding out, but not many. Mm-hmm. And that,
well, you were a singularitarian when you started.
I was a doctrinaire libertarian and singularitarian, and I'm not a doctrinaire anything anymore. So,
and the original C Realm was singularitarian in its perspective, or did you
largely already... yeah. Here, that was a big, another, you know, going back to the early days of podcasting, mm-hmm. it was a lot easier to get guests in the early days than it is now, because there weren't very many podcasts. Like,
right.
mostly I had to explain to people what a podcast was. And I basically said it was a radio show on the internet. So mm-hmm. people were agreeing to a radio interview. And, you know, when they heard my professional, you know, voice, that reinforced that. It's much harder today. Like, much, much fewer. I have a much lower response rate to invitations now than I did in 2008.
Yeah, I miss that too. I mean, I tend to have a, I can reach out to people who are publishing a book for a leftist audience and generally get a positive response. There's still, I don't think I could get Cornel West on, although I have friends who do a podcast that, and they've had him on, bastards. But overall, it's flooded. The podcasting world is flooded. And I thought it was big enough when I started. I thought I was late to the game, really.
No, nope, you're super early.
2009. When did YouTube start? And then when did podcasting? YouTube was after podcasting, right?
I don't know the exact origin of YouTube, but they were an independent company when they started, and then mm-hmm. Google bought them.
Right.
I could turn Alexa on and ask her when that happened, but I don't know off the top of my head.
Right. But it was early. It was like 2004-ish, I think, or 2005 or 6 when it was around the same time that the first iPhone came out that YouTube hit my consciousness anyway. And I was not podcasting, but I was shortly to podcast, but podcasting had been around for a few years before that. It was like 2004-3 when podcasting started.
I discovered podcasts in 2006.
Right.
So, and I don't know when they started exactly, but you know, since I'm the center of the universe, they started in 2006.
Yeah, I'm sure that's true. Yeah. And, but you didn't feel late to the game when you,
not at all.
Yeah. Okay. But I think because I knew you, I thought, oh, well, he's been doing it for 3 years already. Behind the schedule. And back here then, 3 years seemed like a substantial amount of time.
Yes. You know? You're younger.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. You've kept with the podcasting, but it's taken different forms. But you never were, you did try to start on YouTube for a little while.
So YouTube. In 2019, my New Year's resolution was to post a video to YouTube every day. Hmm. And most of them, you know, were just selfie videos shot with a smartphone. And I did that. I mean, I think I missed 2 or 3 days, but you know, for most of the year, it was a pretty close to 100% hit rate on that. And my audience grew to the point where I could monetize. But since then I have been shadow banned. And I know that I've been shadow banned because, you know, one, my viewer stats went from several hundred to less than 100 for each upload. But more importantly, I started noticing that, you know, if I made a comment on some popular video, that the comments before and after mine might get hundreds of likes and mine would get 3. And then I realized the test is, okay, make the comment, post it. I can see it. Now log out and reload the page. Whoop, my comment's gone.
Huh.
So, and just this year, like, I don't know when the shadow ban hit, but I know that just this year, I got a message from YouTube saying that, you know, I was in the penalty box for 30 days, couldn't upload because I had advocated, I had posted something that advocated for violent criminal content. I'm like, what the fuck are you talking about? Right. Turns out an old podcast of mine in which I had read from the Unabomber's Manifesto, I had uploaded it as a video years ago, but you know, their algorithms are always combing through your past archive, looking for new sins based on a, you know, a newly constrained code of conduct. And so, you know, of course I appealed, and of course the appeal was algorithmically denied. And so now I can go to my, you know, my behind the scenes page, and there's you know, a community guideline strike. It's active, and I got demonetized. And, you know, while I was prevented from uploading new videos for 30 days, my hundreds of other videos, which have not been flagged as harmful, they're still not able to, you know, generate income for me. Mm-hmm. And the, you know, the ban, the demonetization ban is for 90 days. And then I have to start over as if I was, you know, applying for the first time.
Wow. Well, okay. Yeah. Now wait, let me, okay. I've had, a community guidelines warning mm-hmm. put on this channel, and I had something like that put on the Zero Books channel, but for a different reason, that I took care of. There was like a copyright thing. Mm-hmm. On the, so I just had to pay somebody some money and they took it down. But
copyright's a very different issue from, you know, thought control.
Right. No, I know. But but since I started this channel, I had a community guidelines warning. It was over using ASMR that was basically like a woman breathing during sex kind of ASMR mm-hmm. that I put in the background behind an animation of a work by Duchamp called The Bride Stripped Bare, just to make this sort of artistic collage as a part of a longer video. And that gave me a community guidelines warning. Because I guess
I thought that was a whole genre on YouTube.
Well, it was, but they wanted to get rid of it. So the reason I found the ASMR audio on YouTube, but I've also had videos demonetized for other reasons, for content reasons, political content reasons. And I do feel as though I'm being not completely shadow banned, but suppressed a bit. It feels like it. It feels like everybody who's independent is at this point. But you didn't get any warning. You didn't get a community guidelines warning strike or anything like that. You just went right
to the penalty box
because you read the Unabomber Manifesto.
Right. Which had been published in the Washington Post.
Right. Right. And this is 2020 this happened, or 2019, or
this is just this year. This is just
this year. Okay.
February.
Yeah.
I've been locked out before. I forget what my previous sins were. But in every case, it was not a recent video. It was always something in the archive. So either somebody found the video and found it objectionable and complained,
mm-hmm.
Or, you know, they're just constantly tightening the restrictions in terms of what is allowed to be said, and then applying it retroactively. So they comb through your past archive to see, you know, if there's anything that wasn't a sin before but is now, if they can get you on it. And a lot of people are leaving YouTube for just that reason. But, you know, like I've looked at Rumble,
mm-hmm.
and there's nothing on Rumble that I want to watch, at least that I can find.
Right.
So, you know, it's not very inviting to me. It's not like a community that I'm interested in joining. So I don't know. I'm going to focus on the written word for now. Substack seems to be a bastion of free thought and free speech for the moment. So
Substack's good. And they can do podcasts there as well. Mm-hmm. But you know that in the last, since 2020, but over the last year, it's been revealed the degree to which the Department of Homeland Security is setting up the moderation guidelines for.
Well, not just tech. Not just the Department of Homeland Security.
No.
I mean, all of the three that are acronym agencies have their, you know, their direct red line phone to folks at not so much Twitter anymore now that it's X, but like really what killed the C-Rome podcast was when I got kicked off of Facebook, because that was my main way of connecting with the audience, was the Friends of the C-Rome group on Facebook.
Mm-hmm.
And
it was big, right?
Yeah. It had thousands of, you know, of people signed up and hundreds of active participants.
Right.
And I got kicked off when I posted something that somebody didn't like to a Star Trek discussion group, and they reported me to Facebook for impersonation. And so, you know, Facebook sent me an automated letter saying, you know, send us a copy of your ID. And I wrote back and I said, hey, I need to talk to a human about this. And I got, you know, basically the same automated message again. And then I got, you know, I had been on Facebook for a decade, and with the click of, you know, somebody's fingers or the flipping of a simulated toggle, all of my posts, a decade's worth of content eliminated, just mm-hmm. gone, mm-hmm. you know, from Facebook. And I stayed off of Facebook for years, but then a couple of years ago, I was thinking of buying a car and I wanted to, you know, look for cars on Facebook. So I created a new account and I was banned again within a day.
For what? Because they figured out who you are.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, it's yeah. It's well, I mean, just to kind of underscore and underline the point you just made, you had created content for Facebook.
Yep.
Giving people a reason to be on the platform that they were monetizing. I mean, you were just one of
millions,
but yeah. But nonetheless, you're one of millions who was not just posting about your kids to a few people, but creating a real audience on Facebook. And they just decided, nope, that you didn't have any rights to your content anymore.
They didn't decide. Some human being that didn't like me abused their reporting procedures, knowing that the case would never come before an actual human mind, that it would all be handled algorithmically, you know, at a time when the algorithms weren't nearly as sophisticated. Like, they couldn't make inferences then the way they do now. This is in the, you know, around the ChatGPT-1 era.
Mm-hmm.
Today, it might go differently. You know, today I might explain myself and Facebook large language model might look at what I said and say, oh yeah, that makes sense. Okay. But back then that was not a possibility.
You know, the way to get things resolved, I found for you on YouTube is to tweet at the YouTube account, the right YouTube account. It's like I don't remember the name of it, but like I tried using their system to get rid of a strike or something and didn't get any response. It was all automated, but then I tweeted at the right handle and it got resolved within a day. So
are you familiar with Pi, the large language model from Inflection?
No, tell me about Pi.
I like it. It's one of the better large language model chatbots. And I was just chatting with it one day about I forget what, but I typed the word gobbledygook. But I accidentally put a space between gobbledy and gook. So just the word G-O-O-K, immediately it killed the conversation. It suspended my account. It said, you're done. Bad thing, bad man. I cannot talk to you anymore. Bad person. And I sent several emails to the company and none of them got any sort of response. So I wrote about it on Substack. And the next day, I was back. My account was restored. So yeah, complain in public is much better than, you know, getting in line and going hat in hand and saying, please, sir, I think I've been good.
Mm-hmm.
Please let me back.
But so ours, both of us are kind of telling this tale of this contradictory kind of paradoxical tale of the way that the internet provided an opportunity for self-expression and entrepreneurship, you know,
the early internet.
Yeah.
Yeah. The thoroughly captured platform centric corporate internet is a very different place.
Yeah. But on the other hand, like, okay, but Facebook was a big part of your podcasting business model because it was.
Yep.
Centralized and so dominant and such a big monopoly. So you could reach huge audiences through Facebook, especially in the early days.
I was a late adopter to Facebook, though. I don't think I was actually on it until like 2012.
Yeah.
Like, I'd been podcasting for 6 years before I started, you know, participating on Facebook.
Well, I wanted to ask you about your thoughts about AI, because you're actually the right person to talk to about this. I've used AI just to do searches through Bing, because I feel like Google is such crap now. It can't, like, I have to find some other way to do searches for information, and Bing is okay. But I've noticed that it gets things wrong quite a lot.
Yeah. That's called hallucination. And to a large language model, the only thing, like an answer which is germane, an answer which answers, you know, which answers to the interest of the user is the correct answer. Whether or not it's factually accurate it's really hard to get the large language models to take that into consideration. And, you know, the one person who says, hey, why don't we build a truth-seeking large language model is roundly vilified. This being, you know, Elon Musk. He said, hey, why don't we make an AI that seeks to understand the true nature of the universe and looks for factual information? And he's a villain. You know, it's like, oh, you're just, you know, that's the Third Reich.
I don't think people think that about him because he wants to seek out the truth.
No, it's the other way. I mean, they have an opinion about Elon Musk. And if he says that it's Tuesday, well, then it must be Saturday because he's a Nazi.
Right. I'm not sure if it's hallucinations that I'm encountering or something else, because the thing I've discovered they're wrong about, the being is wrong about the most often, is if I ask, is this disinformation agency nonprofit federally funded? Do they get money from the UK state? What is always, there's no evidence of any federal funding. And then I go to their actual website and it's like, we've received a grant from these federal agencies. It's like they're on the publicly, it's not even hidden. It's like public knowledge that they do get federal funding, these different organizations, but Bing won't tell me that. So I'll go back to Bing and say, you know, actually, on their website, it says they do. And it's, oh, thank you for the correction.
Yep. I won't remember that correction. You can ask me again tomorrow, and I'll give you the same answer I did today. Right. The thing with the large language models is you cannot take what they say as verified fact. You can take it as a starting point for an investigation, but then you have to go and verify the facts yourself. And, you know, an easy way to just start that process is to cut and paste your question into a different large language model. So, you know, start with Bing and look at its answer and then go to Claude. You familiar with Claude?
No.
Claude is probably the most powerful of the publicly available free large language models right now. But it's not the most knowledgeable. Like Pi, the one I like, is not nearly as intelligent, but it knows a lot more. And most of them don't have access to the web. You know, so they can't just go and Google it for you and then synthesize the data. Google's large language model can, Gemini. But Gemini is the most reluctant to discuss anything that is, you know, seemingly edgy. So, you know,
Gemini's the one that wouldn't show you a picture of a white person a little while ago.
Yes. you know, that made a lot of news, but for years, if you just go to Google image search and you type in white couple, it will make a point of showing you mixed race couples. As if to say, you are a bad person to even want that. This is not what you asked for, but this is what you need, you evil white supremacist. Here's a picture of happy white and black people together, you know, raising families. So if you wanted a picture of a white couple, you go in and type in Irish couple.
And even then, no, but on with Gemini, if you type in Irish couple, you're going to get like a Native American and you know, whatever.
That was for a few days. They took that down pretty quickly because that went viral in a very embarrassing way.
Well, I want to get back to discussing your novel a little bit before we wrap up. We're coming up on an hour. I shouldn't get rid of you. I should just hold on to you for as long as you're here to fill up the time on this.
Well, do you have somebody scheduled for the next hour?
I have yeah, someone at 9:30 coming in. I wanted to show a clip from Andrew Filippone's short film. I'd show the whole thing, Charlie Rose by Samuel Beckett, which is from 2012. And I interviewed him. He was one of the first people who I got on who had gone viral with this YouTube video. It got 300,000 views. But I thought that is ginormous at the time.
Yeah, that's bigger than my biggest video for sure.
I think I made one on Jordan Peterson that got 500,000.
So wow.
That was, I got lucky. That's what made the YouTube channel really at zero. It was like that video. And then after that, they all get tens of thousands of views for a while.
I remember you had an interaction with Jordan Peterson just before he got famous. And so, you know, you were denied your opportunity to confront him because suddenly he was, you know, in a different league. And not.
Yeah, I contacted his publicist and scheduled an interview and got a date and locked down and we were going to do it. And he had been saying, no Marxist will debate me. And I'm like, I'm right here. I'll do it. And then suddenly it was like radios. His schedule won't permit him to do this. And then no response to my follow-ups. Like, I can make my schedule fit his. One would be.
You know who Richard Hanania is?
No, who's Richard? I should know these people. Who is it?
He's kind of right-wing-ish, you know, but he's young and in a new way. He shows up on shows like Rising and Breaking Points. Mm-hmm. You know, he's in that crew, which means he's, you know, just a couple degrees of separation from you, because you know, people you know appear on those shows. Mm-hmm. But he was just kind of blowing up, and I reached out to him on Twitter and I asked him if he'd be on a podcast, and he said yes. And then when we went to set the time, he wrote back and he said, you know, I talked to my publicist and they said that I should only do mainstream podcasts. And this is like less than a day later that he went from yes to I've been advised not to. So that really stokes the paranoia. It's like, there's a secret file on me. I don't have access to it, but other people do. What does I mean, it say?
I'm going to say something that I will probably never have to, I'll never be tested on, right? Uh-huh. But I don't care. Like, if I suddenly somehow become big, I will never turn down a podcast based on its size. You know, maybe I can do the scheduling, but it just doesn't make any sense either to not go on a podcast if you have the time, because you never know who's going to watch. And it's just, it's bad form to say, I'm sorry, you're not big enough. It's just, that's not the community of podcasting I come from.
Yeah.
You know,
I've known Douglas Rushkoff since long before podcasting was a thing. He was an internet friend from the early days. And I've had him on the show repeatedly. But I asked him a couple of years ago, and he said, yes, but I'm so busy. I'm doing multiple podcast interviews a day. It's going to take me a while. And that was a couple of years ago. And still every few months, he'll send me an email saying, hey, you're still in the pipeline. I'm still, you know, looking to make it happen, but I don't want to do more than one a day. And the line is so long. So, you know, there does come a point where you really do have to apply some sort of filtering mechanism.
True. Yeah. I mean, I was going to say, I'm not. You know, I'm not Douglas Rushkoff, and even I'm surprised Douglas Rushkoff is still Douglas Rushkoff. But anyway, it's been a while since I've heard from him. You know, like,
he's quite big. Apparently, he's got his own podcast. You know, and it's he certainly doesn't need, you know, whatever boost I can give him to get his message out. He would be doing me a favor, you know, by being on the show.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's been on before on your show, right?
Many times.
Yeah.
No, I picked him up at the Washington D.C. airport, not Dulles. What's the other one? Reagan. Mm-hmm. In my old pickup truck, and drove him to PBS headquarters in Crystal City, Virginia, where he was going to give a talk. And we recorded a podcast interview, like just in the lobby, like on a landing in the stairs. You know, just me and him sitting on a bench with my portable recorder. You know, that's the level of connection that I have with him. But yeah, now if I want him on my podcast, it's a period of years of waiting.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm sure he'll come back eventually.
Well, he might also, you know, check my podcast feed from time to time and see that I'm not putting stuff out regularly. So he's probably going to default to people who are.
Right. So, listen, I want to run this video.
Okay. I can hang out until half past, you know.
Yeah, that sounds great. And so see if I can figure out how to get it on the screen here.
Do I have to watch the video, or can I go get a cup of coffee?
Oh, well, it's only a few minutes, but yeah, you can go get a cup of coffee.
All right.
Afterwards, you have to pretend like you saw it. No, okay. But I won't. I'll show it to everyone else. See if I can get it.
Okay.
Welcome to the broadcast. Tonight, a conversation about the future of technology and the internet and mobile devices and all that. We talked to Charlie Rose for the first time. Welcome. The future of technology coming up. What will the web do to content in terms of high cost, expensive, time consuming content? My perception is, you would know this much more than I do. Okay, tell me four or five of those that we ought to take a look at that are startups that have a brilliant idea. Microsoft and Yahoo. Microsoft, Yahoo. Microsoft and Yahoo. Microsoft, Yahoo. Microsoft, Microsoft, Yahoo. Yahoo. Microsoft, Yahoo. Microsoft and Yahoo. Microsoft, Yahoo. Why wasn't Yahoo Yahoo? Steve is not happy with the process so far. Microsoft
don't
and do that.
Yahoo.
Google. No, we're not going to do that. I can never get Craig to talk to me about his economic model. Google. No, we're not going to do that. Google, Radiohead, blogs, Google, Microsoft and Yahoo, Google, Microsoft, Yahoo. Yahoo. We're making all this money and our stock price is going through the roof. And how can we use this advantage to enter new markets, to expand our market share, to beat the hell out of everybody? Steve is not happy. What's going to happen?
We're muted. Okay.
Because I was laughing out loud during that.
Yeah. I had the Andrew Filippone on the podcast, and I grabbed a clip from that, but somehow on my trip to New York, I didn't get it onto this laptop, so I can't run the clip of my interview with him. But he was just, his story, I like got him on the podcast and said, how did you decide to make this? And he's like, well, I have like iMovie. And I was fooling around. I put it on. I took a college course on avant-garde filmmaking, and I thought I'd try my hand at it. And I made that, and some people liked it, and it made the rounds and went a little bit viral. But somehow in 2012, that seemed really unique. Kind of edited up found footage approach. I think that probably it is something like that uploaded every second to YouTube now. But
at the same time, it's also that art form is done. It's over. Because now you can just go to 11 Labs with a clip of Charlie Rose and train an AI voice, to sound like Charlie Rose and create, a 3D avatar that looks just like Charlie Rose. And you can have him say whatever you want. So there's no need to listen to hours and hours of his interviews and to cut, and splice and be creative like that.
Right.
The constraints that the technology put upon you required you to exercise a certain creativity, which is no longer required, you can say people could still do that. You, Doug Lane, could still make mixtapes in the style that you did like in the late 80s and mid 90s, but you won't.
No, I don't make mixtapes, but I still make these critical cuts videos. And they're kind of in that same, I mean, not exactly like that, but they're, I still use basically cuts to edit things together. I don't go to an AI to generate my footage, but
because it's not convenient yet.
Yeah. I wonder what will happen when it is. I've heard it debated whether or not what we're headed for is a world in which KMO goes home at the end of his day and sits down in front of his computer or TV, types in a phrase or two, and a movie is made for him based on what he wants to watch by some AI, or whether or not there will still be small percentage of creators now, instead of filmmakers or painters or novelists or whatever, but just creators in the abstract, who will be making movies, maybe using AI technology to assist, but that will still be authors, and whether that will be preferable for most people rather than the ones they can generate just using their own imagination with a few phrases. What do you think?
Well, let's loop back. Remember when Podomatic was overreporting, you know, listener stats?
Yeah.
Imagine you're doing a podcast and your stats are amazing. And beyond that, you're getting a flood of listener feedback that is very clear that your audience is very intelligent and they're listening very closely and they get what you're trying to communicate. And beyond that, a lot of them, are very attractive. And they're very impressed with you and they think very highly of you and let you know that all day long. And then you encounter a story about people caught in these little micro celebrity bubbles where all of the feedback they're getting is AI generated. And then you have to wonder, oh shit, does any human listen to my podcast? Is it even going out to anyone? Or is there just an AI pandering to me all day long, stoking my ego and feeding my neurology saying, oh, you're so good. That's so creative. Oh, will you marry me? You're so beautiful. You're so wonderful.
Well, listen, will these AIs sign up to your Patreon? Because, you know, in that world, if you get, I'm fine with it. You don't have to do
this. Exactly.
But I do think that will be the divide, you know.
Do you know who Kai-Fu Lee is?
I'm going to just say no. I've not reached the point of brain deadness that you could probably say, you know, who William Shatner is.
I know you know who William Shatner is. Yes. Beyond that, you know who Scott Bakula is.
I do know who Scott Bakula is.
Someday. We'll get back to that. Doug had proposed many years ago that we do a podcast where we go through Star Trek Enterprise episode by episode.
Oh yeah, it'd be great. Yeah.
So anyway,
we could probably make big money on that. Okay. Anyway, go ahead.
Where was I going? What was the question?
Oh, something about you asked me if I knew who someone was, and I.
Oh, Kai-Fu Lee, right? Yeah. So Kai-Fu Lee, he's worked for Apple, he's worked for Google, and he's worked for a lot of the big Chinese tech companies. And he made a splash several years ago. He wrote a book called AI Superpowers. Mm-hmm. And superpowers like, you know, the USA and USSR, not superpowers like, you know, flight and regeneration or whatever. And he wrote a follow-up book, and I forget the title. It's not as memorable. It's AI and then a year. I forget what the year is, but in it, he tells several fictionalized stories of people living in the not too distant future in a world that's shaped, not necessarily run by AI, but shaped by AI. And one of the questions is, you know, that the characters in this, it's not a novel, but the characters in these scenarios are grappling with is, we don't really need human labor, but humans need to be needed. How can we fool people into thinking that they're actually working and generating something of value? And there are, you know, various companies that's not their publicly stated goal, but that's their behind the scenes goal. We need to involve people, you know, a lot of people every day, have them do something they wouldn't do except, you know, unless they were getting paid. And we don't need the output of their activity. The goal is to keep them under the illusion that they are participants when they are not. Mm. You know, and this is somebody who, he's not just some guy. I mean, this is a guy who's very influential. He goes to China and he gives lectures at universities and thousands of people show up, you know, thousands of people who are looking to get into the tech industry and, you know, who are knowledgeable, smart people in a way that you and I are not smart. You know, neither of us is a coder or a numbers guy or a statistician or anything like that. And this, you know, so he's looking at AI and he's looking down the track and he sees this as a big problem. It's like, what do we do with all these human beings who depend on working as part of their validation, you know, as part of their self-image as a useful, productive member of society? What do you do with all those people when AI can do everything they do much faster, at least as well, if not better, and way cheaper.
You know, from a Marxist perspective, it becomes a two-sided question, because it's not only what do you do with the people, but also how do you maintain profitability in a world which is so fully automated? Because, you know, to make it simple, Marxists believe in the labor theory of value, which means that the commodities around us get their value from the amount of time that people spend working to make them. And as we speed up production, they get cheaper, which is good because it makes it easier to distribute when things are cheap. More people can get access to it. But if they get too cheap too quickly, then the profitability goes into crisis. And so if you have not enough need to employ human beings to do work, and you know, this solution of fake jobs that are, you know, in a kind of a Prisoner meets the Truman Show virtual reality solution will only work to the extent that some humans somewhere are doing productive work that can prop up this gigantic financialized system.
Why would humans be doing any productive work when it is cheaper and more efficient to have machines do it?
Well, because the efficiency turns against itself under capitalism due to the labor theory of value. So,
but the competitive nature of capitalism means that the person who decides to produce an inferior product that takes longer and costs more to create is just throwing up their hands and losing the competition.
I know. So the way this has worked out in the past is that new realms that require human labor open up, and also you also find areas where labor is super cheap, so you can take longer or require more human beings, but because the labor is so cheap, it's still more cost efficient than buying the equipment to automate. So those are kind of some of the ways in which that's overcome and has been overcome so far. But what most people leave out, like do you remember the Kurt Vonnegut novel, Player Piano?
I know of it. I'm not sure I ever read it.
Yeah, but it's basically about a world where human beings don't have to work anymore and they don't have a usefulness. Everything's automated. And it was written in, I think, the 50s or early 60s or something like that. And the idea after World War II was that through state management of the economy and monetary policies and things like that, and redistribution policies through the welfare state, there would no longer be a need for, it's not so much that there wouldn't be a need for human labor. There might not be, and that would be a social problem, but there wouldn't be economic crisis. We wouldn't face a depression again. We wouldn't have problems of profitability on a global scale again. In the 70s and then in 2008, we've seen that that's not the case. So one of the unintended consequences of a world that would be run virtually and everyone just would think they had a job, which is just like a variation on UBI, right? It just, this is like, you don't know you're getting the benefit.
Right.
So you're easier to manage. But even in that world, there would be financial crises. There would be real world economic problems, even if the real world is just like everything else on a computer. There will be numbers that matter and numbers that don't matter. There'll be, this solution is a pseudo solution, but it has a consequence. So one of the ways to think about
even in Kai-Fu Lee's book, it doesn't work.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
The strategy of having people play video games all day and telling them that it's work doesn't work. People figure it out pretty quickly that, you know, they're not needed.
Right. Well, Bash Bash Revolution is sort of like this, only I imagine that we overcome the value form is how I would put it as a ex-Kleinmanite. But
now, I actually read Bash Bash Revolution.
Oh, yeah.
I read after the saucers landed.
Yeah.
So are you going to read Fear and Loathing in the Copper
Belt? Yeah, I will. I will. I will read it. I'll tell you what, I'll read it all and have you back on and to really talk about it. Right and on. Because it's only fair. That's how it works. But also, it does seem like it would be fun.
I will say that Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt is longer than all of your novels combined.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well, then that's not fair. Are you going to make an audiobook version? Okay. That spring to mind, but
here's the thing. Yes, I've thought about this quite a bit. I have a few choices with that. I could read it myself, but it has multiple female characters who are going to need different voices. And that's not such a huge concern because I can use an AI voice changer. In fact, I've been creating the audiobook for the novella, Last Train to Mordor, which is a prelude to the novel. Mm-hmm. And I've been recording it myself and then using 11 Labs to change my voice into a woman's voice. Because if you just enter text, the cadence is not very good. So I can read it in my own voice, provide the cadence, and then switch over to, you know, have the AI insert a woman's voice. And it's not just a filter that's being run by my voice. It is, in fact, a freshly generated, you know, voice track, but using my, you know, my recorded input as a guide. And it sounds great, but it's very time consuming. The novel is very long. It would take me months to do it as an audiobook. So I could do it myself, but I'd rather spend that time, you know, researching and writing the sequel. Or I could pay somebody to do it, but you know, if you go to ACX, that's the Amazon, you know, program that connects authors with narrators, people want $100, $200 per hour of finished audio. And this book's probably going to be like 15 hours or so. I don't have the cash to do that. Some people will, you know, they'll do it for a percentage of the sales, but you know, my novel hasn't sold much in its paperback or Kindle form. So I would feel bad, you know, saying, hey, go do a shit ton of work for no guaranteed reward. And two, you know, if somebody agrees to do that, then I have to wonder, it's going to take them a long time. The whole time that they're supposedly working on it, I have to wonder, are they actually working on it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, given the lack of a guarantee of a payoff at the end, are they going to get bored? Are they going to, is life just going to overwhelm them? So the next option is Amazon has just introduced virtual voice it's free. If you have a book, you know, published through Amazon, you can take it over to Audible and they will provide the narration for free. You can pick the voice, but so far the virtual narrators, which sound pretty good, they can't do different voices for different characters.
Right.
And that would be really important in this particular novel.
Hmm.
Yeah. So right now I'm just kind of in a holding pattern. Like I know that the capabilities of the AI narration will be vastly expanded a year from now. I might just wait a year.
This is interesting. You know, we're about to introduce a bunch of audiobooks. Like we're going to do historical socialist texts as audiobooks only to start with. We're going to have original books that are only coming out as audiobooks.
Only
the plan. Yeah, at first, and then if they do well, we'll make them into print editions. But the idea was, well, the overhead will be low, it'll just be a matter of my time or Ashley's time to read them. Mm-hmm. And a lot of critical theory presses don't do that. Like, I don't think there's a lot of the left wing presses are slow to create audiobooks for the most part. But now, with this AI virtual voice thing, I bet you're just going to have, I think everyone's just going to start, all publishers are just going to start releasing audiobooks that way pretty soon. How good are they?
Go to Audible and do a search and, you know, search for narrator and just put in virtual voice and it will bring up an endless list of titles and you can sample each of them. You know, you won't sample each of them. You wouldn't have time, but you can sample a few and just listen.
Yeah. But do you think they're as good as a human can do at this point?
Not yet. Again, the problem is cadence, like, and stress. I this jumped out at me. I was listening to, it seemed like a young adult science fiction novel that somebody had put up, and the virtual voice narrator sounded good, but one character, like two characters meet in a park. They've never met before. They're young people and they're just hanging out in the park. And one character says, "What are you doing here?" And the other character says, "What are you doing here?" in the exact same cadence. But no, the other character would say, "What are you doing here?"
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. But the same, we're at a point right now where the same string of, you know, of words is going to get the exact same treatment, even if it's repeated twice in a row, when, you know, a human being would realize, no, there's going to be a different stress in the second instance,
you know? Right. So,
but the AI is going to figure that out pretty quickly, pretty quickly.
Also, if you have someone who's a listener, they could probably, you could get the whole thing generated by AI and go through and have another AI assist you in quick editing to change the stress on the second line if you wanted, you know, like even now before they get the bots smart enough to do it automatically.
Well, even now, I don't know about Amazon's virtual voice, but if you use 11 Labs, which is right now like the leader in synthesized voice technology, or some of their competitors, you can choose an emotional valence for any particular strip of text. So you could say, okay, read this line angry, or read this line sad, or read this line, you know, amused, and it will change like that. But then you have sacrificed the just push a button and the whole book is done for you to push a button and some, you know, a raw product that you have to go through line by line and adjust is created for you, which for some people, you know, that's not a bad thing because that reserves a place for human judgment and human creativity. Whereas, you know, the push button approach eliminates a lot of human judgment and creativity.
Yeah. Well, I'm just going to hold out the hope that it, people will prefer to listen to and watch and read real human beings' works and ideas, even as robots get better and better.
Well, there will come a time in the very near future when you can train an AI to speak in your voice with your cadence. And then the choice will be, do I spend hours and hours and hours reading and editing audio, or do I just let the AI do it for free?
I think that I think that would really depend on how smart it was. If it was going to be significantly worse than my own version, I guess I would spend the hours to do it.
So that there will be a marked difference between April of 2024 and April of 2025.
Right.
In terms of what the AI can do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's so. Brings us back to your novel, because at the beginning of this conversation, you mentioned that the way you wanted to write your novel was to have ChatGPT or some other AI help you do it. And you ended up realizing that just by writing the sample sections, you had started writing your novel. And so you continued on from there.
Right. The AI could not do what I could do myself, right. Which is, I felt a sense of extreme urgency. Like if I'm going to write a novel, it's got to be now, because the temptation to just let AI do it, you know, even just a few years from now, I think is going to be overwhelming. And at the same time, just the process of getting up every day and discovering the story by writing it, that was very gratifying. I want to get back to that.
Okay. The novelist in me has, I'm having a reaction to this. I mean, it's been a long while since I've written fiction, and I want to get back to it. In fact, I'm supposed to get back to it for a pamphlet series that Alfie Bounds publishing. And I'm like, what month is that? I'm 4 months late now. I don't think an AI could write a Kurt Vonnegut novel or could write Slaughter.
Not yet.
Ever. I don't think ever. And I don't think that.
I wouldn't take that bet, but let's, you know, we've been talking for how many years?
Oh, well, 15.
Let's make a note of this conversation and revisit the topic in a couple years.
Okay. All right. who's your favorite novelist? You know, I've mentioned Kurt Vonnegut because he's like,
I've read a lot of Kurt Vonnegut. I like his stuff. In terms of sci-fi, like my all-time favorites are Gene Wolfe, Ursula K. Le Guin, Octavia Butler. I like David Brin's stuff. I was much more into it in my earlier days than I am now. Ian M. Banks, love the Culture series. These are some of my all-time favorites. These are the things that I was making sly reference to in the novel.
Right. Well, okay. So what I'm saying is that I don't think anybody could write a Kurt Vonnegut novel. Any human being could write a Kurt Vonnegut novel today either. And I don't think that anyone today could write a Douglas Coupland novel like Generation X. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that, I feel like fiction arises in historical moments from out of people who are living in that moment and are shaped by it and reflecting on it. And an AI might be able to generate a similar style or similar sentences and absolutely replicate like a Kurt Vonnegut style or I think it'd be pretty easy to do a Philip K. Dick story by an AI. And I even think mm-hmm. should be amongst the first things that are written that way, just because it would make him turn over in his grave. But I don't think that they would be able to endure or reach an audience in the same way that, like, I don't know, Portnoy's Complaint did, Philip Roth, or just these people who are expressing something that is general to the culture in a moment, at least, you know.
So two things on that, since we're just down to the last couple of minutes.
Yeah.
One, given the constraints that you put on, you know, what it means for a novelist to write a novel, Kurt Vonnegut can't write a Kurt Vonnegut novel in 2024.
No, he's dead.
He's dead. Right. So there will be no new Kurt Vonnegut novels. But at the same time, if he were still alive, he couldn't write a novel in the style of Kurt Vonnegut of 1975.
True. And
moment is past.
This is what happens to artists. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear about people saying, oh, he's desperate to stay relevant. He's become a parody of himself.
Yeah.
It's because at a certain point, you no longer are engaged in your life in a self-reflective way, but you've fallen into a pattern and been no longer striving to fully understand.
Have you seen the movie Frequently Asked Questions About Time Travel?
Yes.
So, but fans go back in time and they kill artists before they descend into self-parody.
Right. So, So like Kurt Vonnegut's later novels, certainly his last one, which was called Timequake, it was not as significant a book. It was just not. If that had been his, it was okay. It was fun, but it was not
What's your favorite Vonnegut novel?
I like Slaughterhouse-Five quite a lot. I like Breakfast of Champions. There's Player Piano is not bad at all.
Have you read Bluebeard?
Yeah, I've read Bluebeard, but it's been a long time.
That's my favorite.
Mother Night.
I never read Mother Night.
Yeah. So yeah. Anyway. I think of novelists as being about engaging with and kind of putting the history and the culture into perspective for people.
The other point I wanted to make about your previous argument, you mentioned finding an audience, and I think so much of what AI is going to be generated will be for an audience of one. You know, you mentioned this earlier. You come home, you sit down in front of the TV, you pick up the remote, you turn it on, and it just starts generating content that is created specifically for you based not only on your interests, but on real-time feedback from like your pupils and how much they're dilating and your galvanic skin response and your pulse. You know, the AI will know second to second whether or how well the content that it's generating for you is being received, and it will alter the presentation based on that data. So yeah, finding an audience might not be relevant.
I don't know. I think that people are going to want, like you and I want to do this podcast about the Star Trek show Enterprise, where people are in the future going to want to share our culture. And if you go home and have a probe stuck up your ass to monitor what you really want to watch right now, you know, or whatever it is, that's or, you know, put little diodes on your head to exactly read your mind to produce exactly what you desire as an individual, you won't be able to go to the water cooler the next day, even if it is just a virtual one in a pseudo job.
Will be able to go to the virtual one in the pseudo job and talk to a pseudo or virtual coworker, and they will have seen exactly what you saw and you can discuss it with them.
Oh my God. Yeah. All right.
But here, imagine this. Somebody watches this stream and they think, yeah, I really want to see that, you know, or listen to that podcast series where Doug Lane and KMO go through Star Trek Enterprise episode by episode. But you and I, we never get around to it. But they'll say, you know, to their AI entertainment device in the future, hey, I want that. Make that for me.
Oh, God.
And it will.
Yeah. It's just the kind of rarefied bullshit that the AI will be good at. All right. Listen, I'm thanks, KMO. I'm going to read your novel. Everyone should read it. You send me a link to it, and I'll put it in the description for this 15-hour stream once it's over. Right. Or and actually, post it into as a comment. Can you post a comment?
We'll see. I can't post links, I don't think. In other
okay. Levels. Well, send it to me, and I'll send it out to through the description and as a comment on this video. And I'll have you back on again after I read it, and we can go over it, and I'll rake you over the coals for your ideological impurity.
All right. Put your finger up. Yeah. It's a pinky swear.
That's a pinky swear. Okay.
All right. Hard part is going to be finishing the novel.
Okay. All right. Talk to you soon.
Congratulations on 15 years.
Thank you. All right. So right now, John.
Authenticity in the age of AI. The human struggle to remain relevant in the face of artificial general intelligence. I just got off a live stream with Doug Lane. To commemorate his 15 years in podcasting, he's doing a 15-hour live stream. I was the first guest of the day. That worked out because I'm an early riser, and it's thematically appropriate because he got into podcasting when he realized, after listening to a few episodes of the CROM podcast, that I didn't have a radio station or a nonprofit backing my efforts. I was just some guy with a microphone, a laptop, and an RSS feed. If I could do it with no budget and consumer-grade equipment, so could he. It makes sense that I would be up first in a retrospective celebration of his podcasting success and longevity. We talked a bit about my novel, but it was clear he'd only read a few pages of it, so we couldn't go very deep. Instead, we talked a lot about AI and the future of human work and creativity. I mentioned Kai-Fu Lee's book, AI 2041, 10 Visions of Our Future, co-authored by Chen Kuifan, though I couldn't bring the exact title to mind in real time. In it, Lee spins several speculative scenarios about the human experience in the age of AI. One nagging question that Lee addresses is, what will humans do when their economic relevance drops to near zero? In one vignette, if I recall correctly, a reporter or researcher talks with the CEO of a startup that employs vast numbers of humans, but it has no actual use for their labor. Instead, the whole purpose of the company is to trick lots of humans into thinking that they're working. In reality, the entire enterprise is a giant adult daycare for people who derive their self-worth from their employment. Doug asked me if I was going to do an audiobook of my novel. I don't really want to do the narration myself. It's a very long novel in which the majority of the main characters are female. I'd want a voice actress who could do distinct voices for the various female characters to narrate the audiobook. Beyond that, it would take me months to record and edit the audiobook myself, and I'd rather spend that time writing the next book. I mentioned that just hiring someone and paying $100 to $200 per finished hour of audio was beyond my means. Amazon's ACX service that matches authors with narrators allows for narrators to receive a percentage of the audiobook sales. Amazon/Audible automates the profit sharing, so the narrator doesn't have to worry about getting stiffed by the author or publisher. My reservation here is that the paperback and Kindle versions of my book haven't sold many copies. A voice actress would be taking a significant risk, offering to do dozens of hours of work up front with no guarantee of a specific return. Not only am I reluctant to ask anyone to take on such a risk, I couldn't be sure that she would complete the daunting task for so tenuous a future payday. Until the finished audio files arrived, I couldn't be sure that the task would ever be finished. The other option is to use Audible's virtual voice technology. They have a number of AI voices to choose from. They're not as good as a talented voice actor, but they're pretty good. And it's free. Plus, the AI spits out the finished product practically instantaneously compared to how long it would take a human to record the narration for a 560-page novel. The only thing that holds me back from jumping on this option is that the AI narrator can't do different voices for the individual characters the way a talented voice actor could. If my book were mostly a conceptual novel, where the characters wear mere masks for ideas, that would be fine. But my novel is character-driven. Each character really needs their own voice. Virtual voice can't do that yet, but I suspect that its capabilities will improve quickly. Or some rival service will present itself in the near future that is better able to deliver work equivalent to that of a talented human narrator at an affordable price point. So my current plan is to wait and see how much and how quickly the technology improves. Doug voiced his expectation that AI narration will never be as good as a talented human narrator. I don't share that intuition, but I also don't claim any oracular powers. AI seems to be improving across a wide spectrum of capabilities at an accelerating rate, but there's no law of nature that says it can't or won't hit a wall or stall out, either temporarily or permanently. Yes, I'm familiar with Kurzweil's so-called law of accelerating returns. It's no more a physical law than Moore's law is. It's an observed phenomenon that seems likely to continue, but it might not. If you object to this, just know that I'm playing devil's advocate here. I fully expect the current rate of improvement to continue and continue to accelerate. As I recall, Doug's position was that AI narration will never be as good as the output of a talented human. It's already much better than what you'd get from your average Walmart shopper or university graduate, but AI has not yet closed the gap with human professionals in this sphere. Rather than argue for my intention, I just pointed out to Doug that we've been talking for 15 years so far, and there's every reason to think that we will continue talking in the future. I suggested putting a pin in this topic and returning to it in a couple of years. On the topic of AI narration, let's establish a baseline. Here's an excerpt from Khan's Choice by Takara.
To the naked eye, Khan looked like your typical hustler, but that was far from the truth. He was living his best immortal life while he waited for his mate until he laid his eyes on Choice. He knew from their first encounter that she was his. Choice was a sweet and caring young lady, living her life like any other normal female. Her age, that was until the mysterious Khan entered her life and changed what her definition of normal was.
I haven't read this book, and I'm not recommending it. I selected it because it uses a female virtual voice. It has a release date of January 14th, 2024, so it either represents the current capabilities of the service or it isn't far behind the state of the art. My evaluation? The voice is easy to understand, but it's clearly artificial. The tonality and enunciation are pleasing to the ear, but the model clearly does not understand what it's reading. Notice the unnatural pause between female and her age in this sentence.
Choice was a sweet and caring young lady, living her life like any other normal female. Her age, that was until the mysterious...
I'm guessing that 1 year from today, Virtual Voice will be able to read that sentence as if it understood the meaning of the words. That's an intuition. By Doug's lights, I'm giving AI too much credit. According to someone like David Shapiro, by this time next year, we'll have real-time, AI-generated, bespoke content creation. You'll turn on YouTube or your TV, and an AI will generate big-budget Hollywood content just for you. Not even just for you, but just for you, how you're feeling in that particular moment. Doug brought up the possibility of bespoke content creation in real time on his own, so he's familiar with the concept, but he said it wouldn't take off because we all want a shared experience that we can discuss with our coworkers by the office water cooler, even if the water cooler is virtual. I responded that in a post-AGI world, your coworker will also be virtual, and he, she, or they will talk like they've seen everything you've seen. In a world where almost all human work is pretend work, simulated coworkers who are familiar with your media diet will just be part of the experience. Will humans always prefer human-generated content over machine-generated content? I think a lot of people will continue to claim this preference in the coming years, but I don't think many of them will be able to pass the Pepsi challenge and reliably distinguish human-generated content from AI-generated content. Right now, I'm fairly confident in my ability to tell human art from AI-generated imagery, provided it hasn't been touched up by a human artist. Many Facebook users don't seem to know what to look for, or don't even realize there is a distinction to be made. I expect AI-generated imagery to grow more difficult to distinguish from human-made images, even as people insist, for ideological reasons, that they prefer human art. What does this mean for people who are driven to create when they are in competition with advanced generative AI for eyeballs and earholes? I pose the following scenario to Doug. You start a podcast, and it takes off. Your download stats are off the hook, and you're getting a flood of listener feedback from intelligent people who really seem to get what you're trying to communicate.
What's more, a lot of them are very attractive and claim to be attracted to you. Suppose then that you learn that some other creators have been taken in by an AI-generated audience. Those other creators are nobodies who think they're famous. Do you hold on to the belief that your audience is real, or do you assume that your success is also simulated? Doug asked, "Are they joining my paid Patreon tier?" He laughed as he asked the question. It's funny, and I took it as a joke. But suppose the answer is yes. You're getting high-quality feedback and financial support from your simulated audience. Is that a good life? Do you continue to create, even though you suspect that it's all a charade? I told Doug that I wrote and published my novel when I did, because it seemed like the temptation to just surrender to the siren song of personalized content creation would soon overwhelm me. If I was ever going to write a novel, it needed to be now. I'll be happy to learn that this was a false intuition. I got the first novel out. Further efforts should come easier now that I know the general shape of the process. If my expectations about the future capabilities of generative AI are false or radically premature, it's all good. The intuition lit a fire under my ass to do something I always meant to do. I feel absolutely no compulsion to argue for the accuracy of my intuitions about the near future. Developments are coming fast these days, and given that I'm about to turn 55, the subjective length of each passing year grows shorter and shorter. I feel no need to make a case for how I see the future playing out. It'll be here before we know it. The universal answer for disagreements about the path we're on, at least for older folks like Doug and me, can just be, let's put a pin in that and revisit this discussion in a couple of years. All right, that was me reading a Substack post. And before that, you heard a conversation that I had with Doug Lane, in which we talked, among other things, about my novel, Fear and Loathing in the Kuiper Belt, Gen X science fiction, which is available in Kindle format and in paperback. The Kindle format is $4.99. The paperback is $23 even. Yeah, I know, that's expensive. Everything's expensive. And if you've made it all the way here to the end of the podcast, I will extend an offer to you that I sent out to the subscribers to my newsletter just a few days ago. I really need positive reviews for my novel on Amazon if it's going to sell to anybody, you know, who doesn't already know who I am. If you would like to read the novel and you promise me that you'll do your best to get a positive review posted if you like the book, and if you don't like it, don't post anything, I will send you a review copy in either PDF or EPUB format. So if you'd like to read the book, but you really can't spare the funds, hit me up, kmo@crealm.com or kmoptimal@gmail.com, and I will send you an electronic copy of the book. Let me know if you'd prefer a PDF or an EPUB copy. All right, that's it. I'll talk to you again soon. If you want to hear more of my voice and follow the comings and goings of the buzzing in my brain, then check out my Substack. I post new essays along with recorded narration every Tuesday and Thursday. All right, I am out. Stay well.